Excerpt from Black Boy by Richard Wright. The eighth grade days flowed in their hungry path, and I grew more conscious of myself. I sat in classes, bored, wondering, dreaming. One long, dry afternoon, I took out my composition book and told myself that I would write a story. It was sheer idleness that led me to it. What would the story be about? It resolved itself into a plot about a villain who wanted a widow's home, and I called it the Voodoo of Hell's Half Acre. It was crudely atmospheric, emotional, psychological, and stemmed from pure feeling. I finished it in 3 days, and then wondered what to do with it. The local Negro newspaper. That's it. I sailed into the office and shoved my ragged composition book under the nose of the man who called himself the editor. "What is that?" he asked. "A story," I said. "A news story?" "No, fiction." "All right, I'll read it," he said. He pushed my composition book back on his desk and looked at me curiously, sucking at his pipe. "But I want you to read it now," I said. He blinked. I had no idea how newspapers were run. I thought that one took a story to an editor and he sat down then and there and read it and said yes or no. "I'll read this and let you know about it tomorrow," he said. I was disappointed. I had taken time to write it and he seemed distant and uninterested. "Give me the story," I said, reaching for it. He turned from me, took up the book, and read 10 pages or more. "Won't you come in tomorrow?" he asked. "I'll have it finished then." I honestly relented. "All right," I said. "I'll stop in tomorrow." I left with the conviction that he would not read it. Now, where else could I take it after he had turned it down? The next afternoon, en route to my job, I stepped into the newspaper office. "Where's my story?" I asked. "It's in the galleys," he said. "What's that?" I asked. I did not know what galleys were. "It's set up in type," he said. "We're publishing it." "How much money will I get?" I asked, excited. "We can't pay for manuscript," he said. "But you sell your papers for money," I said with logic. "Yes, but we're young in business," he explained. "But you're asking me to give you my story, but you don't give your papers away," I said. He laughed. "Look, you're just starting. This story will put your name before our readers. Now that's something," he said. "But if the story is good enough to sell to your readers, then you ought to give me some of the money you get from it," I insisted. He laughed again, and I sensed that I was amusing him. "I'm going to offer you something more valuable than money," he said. "I'll give you a chance to learn to write." I was pleased, but I still thought he was taking advantage of me. "When will you publish my story?" "I'm dividing it into 3 installments, he said. "The first installment appears this week. But the main thing is this. Will you get news for me on a space rate basis?" "I work mornings and evenings for $3 a week," I said. "Oh," he said, "then you better keep that. But what are you doing this summer?" "Nothing." "Then come to see me before you take another job," he said, "and write some more stories." A few days later, my classmates came to me with baffled eyes, holding copies of the Southern Register in their hands. "Did you really write that story?" they asked me.
"Yes."
"Why?"
"Because I wanted to."
"Where did you get it from?"
"I made it up."
"You didn't. You copied it out of a book."
"If I had, no one would publish it."
"But what are they publishing it for?"
"So people can read it."
"Who told you to do that?"
"Nobody."
"Then why did you do it?"
"Because I wanted to," I said again.
They were convinced that I had not told them the truth. We had never had any instruction in literary matters at school. The literature of the nation, or the Negro, had never been mentioned. My schoolmates could not understand why anyone would want to write a story, and, above all, they could not understand why I had called it the Voodoo of Hell's Half Acre. The mood out of which a story was written was the most alien thing conceivable to them. They looked at me with new eyes, and a distance. Suspiciousness came between us. If I had thought anything in writing the story, I had thought that perhaps it would make me more acceptable to them. And now, it was cutting me off from them more completely than ever. At home, the effects were no less disturbing. Granny came into my room early one morning and sat on the edge of my bed.
"Richard, what is this you're putting in the papers?"
she asked.
"A story," I said.
"About what?"
"It's just a story, Granny."
"But they tell me it's been in 3 times.
"It's the same story. It's in 3 parts.
"But what is it about?"
she insisted.
I hedged, fearful of getting into a religious argument.
"It's just a story I made up," I said.
"Then it's a lie," she said.
"Oh, Christ," I said.
"You must get out of this house if you take the name of the Lord in vain,"
she said. Granny, please. I'm sorry, I pleaded. But it's hard to tell you about the story. You see, Granny, everybody knows that the story isn't true, but...
Then why write it?
She asked.
Because people might want to read it. That's the devil's work,
she said and left. My mother was also worried.
Son, you ought to be more serious, she said.
You're growing up now, and you won't be able to get jobs if you let people think that you're weak-minded. Suppose the superintendent of schools would ask you to teach here in Jackson, and he found out that you had been writing stories.
I could not answer her.
I'll be all right, Mama, I said.
Uncle Tom, though surprised, was highly critical and contemptuous. The story had no point, he said, and who ever heard of a story by the title of The Voodoo of Hell's Half Acre? Aunt Addie said that it was a sin for anyone to use the word hell, and that what was wrong with me was that I had nobody to guide me. She blamed the whole thing upon my upbringing. In the end, I was so angry that I refused to talk about the story. From no quarter, with the exception of the Negro newspaper editor, had there come a single encouraging word. It was rumored that the principal wanted to know why I had used the word hell. I felt that I had committed a crime. Had I been conscious of the full extent to which I was pushing against the current of my environment, I would have been frightened altogether out of my attempts at writing. But my reactions were limited to the attitude of the people about me, and I did not speculate or generalize. I dreamed of going north and writing books, novels. The North symbolized to me all that I had not felt and seen. It had no relation whatever to what actually existed. Yet, by imagining a place where everything was possible, I kept hope alive in me. But where had I got this notion of doing something in the future, of going away from home and accomplishing something that would be recognized by others? I had, of course, read my Horatio Alger stories, my pulp stories, and I knew my Get Rich Quick Wallingford series from cover to cover, though I had sense enough not to hope to get rich. Even to my naive imagination, that possibility was too remote. I knew that I lived in a country in which the aspirations of black people were limited, yet I felt that I had to go somewhere and do something to redeem my being alive. I was building up in me a dream which the entire educational system of the South had been rigged to stifle. I was feeling the very thing that the state of Mississippi had spent millions of dollars to make sure that I would never feel. I was becoming aware of the thing that the Jim Crow laws had been drafted and passed to keep out of my consciousness. I was acting on impulses that Southern senators in the nation's capital had striven to keep out of Negro life. I was beginning to dream the dreams that the state had said were wrong, that the schools had said were taboo. Had I been articulate about my ultimate aspirations, no doubt someone would have told me what I was bargaining for, but nobody seemed to know, and least of all did I. My classmates felt that I was doing something that was vaguely wrong, but they did not know how to express it. As the outside world grew more meaningful, I became more concerned, tense. And my classmates and my teachers would say, "Why do you ask so many questions?" Or, "Keep quiet." I was in my 15th year. In terms of schooling, I was far behind the average youth of the nation, but I did not know that. In me was shaping a yearning for a kind of consciousness, a mode of being that the way of life about me had said could not be, must not be, and upon which the penalty of death had been placed. Somewhere in the dead of the southern night, my life had switched onto the wrong track, and without my knowing it, the locomotive of my heart was rushing down a dangerously steep slope, heading for a collision, heedless of the warning red lights that blinked all about me, the sirens and the bells and the screams that filled the air. One morning, I arrived early at work and went into the bank lobby where the Negro porter was mopping. I stood at a counter and picked up the Memphis Commercial Appeal and began my free reading of the press. I came finally to the editorial page and saw an article dealing with one H.L. Mencken. I knew by hearsay that he was the editor of the American Mercury, but aside from that, I knew nothing about him. The article was a furious denunciation of Mencken, concluding with one hot, short sentence: "Mencken is a fool." I wondered what on earth this Mencken had done to call down upon him the scorn of the South. The only people I had ever heard denounced in the South were Negroes, and this man was not a Negro. Then what ideas did Mencken hold that made a newspaper like the Commercial Appeal castigate him publicly? Undoubtedly, he must be advocating ideas that the South did not like. Were there, then, people other than Negroes who criticized the South? I knew that during the Civil War, the South had hated Northern whites, but I had not encountered such hate during my life. Knowing no more of Mencken than I did at that moment,
I felt a vague sympathy for him. Had not the South, which had assigned me the role of a non-man, cast at him its hardest words? Now, how could I find out about this Mencken? There was a huge library near the riverfront, but I knew that Negroes were not allowed to patronize its shelves any more than they were the parks and playgrounds of the city. I had gone into the library several times to get books for the white men on the job. Which of them would now help me to get books? And how could I read them without causing concern to the white men with whom I worked? I had so far been successful in hiding my thoughts and feelings from them, but I knew that I would create hostility if I went about this business of reading in a clumsy way. I weighed the personalities of the men on the job. There was Don, a Jew, but I distrusted him. His position was not much better than mine, and I knew that he was uneasy and insecure. He had always treated me in an offhand, bantering way that barely concealed his contempt. I was afraid to ask him to help me to get books. His frantic desire to demonstrate a racial solidarity with the whites against Negroes might make him betray me. Then how about the boss? No, he was a Baptist, and I had the suspicion that he would not be quite able to comprehend why a black boy would want to read Mencken. There were other white men on the job whose attitudes showed clearly that they were Kluxers or sympathizers, and they were out of the question. There remained only one man whose attitude did not fit into an anti-Negro category, for I had heard the white men refer to him as a Pope lover. He was an Irish Catholic and was hated by the white Southerners. I knew that he read books because I had got him volumes from the library several times. Since he too was an object of hatred, I felt that he might refuse me, but would hardly betray me. I hesitated, weighing and balancing the imponderable realities. One morning, I paused before the Catholic fellow's desk. "I want to ask you a favor," I whispered to him. "What is it?" "I want to read. I can't get books from the library. I wonder if you'd let me use your card?" He looked at me suspiciously. "My card is full most of the time," he said. "I see," I said and waited, posing my question silently. "You're not trying to get me into trouble, are you, boy?" he asked, staring at me. "Oh, no, sir." "What book do you want?" "A book by H.L. Mencken." "Which one?" "I don't know. Has he written more than one?" "He has written several." "I didn't know that." "What makes you want to read Mencken?" "Oh, I just saw his name in the newspaper," I said. "It's good of you to want to read," he said, "but you ought to read the right things." I said nothing. "Would he want to supervise my reading?" "Let me think," he said. "I'll figure out something." I turned from him and he called me back. He stared at me quizzically. "Richard, don't mention this to the other white men," he said. "I understand," I said. "I won't say a word." A few days after, he called me to him. "I've got a card in my wife's name," he said. "Here's mine." "Thank you, sir." "If they suspect you, you'll get in trouble," he said. "I'll write the same kind of notes to the library that you wrote when you sent me for books," I told him. "I'll sign your name." He laughed. "Go ahead. Let me see what you get," he said. That afternoon, I addressed myself to forging a note. Now, what were the names of the books written by H.L. Mencken? I did not know any of them. I finally wrote what I thought would be a foolproof note. "Dear madam, will you please let this boy," I used the word to make the librarian feel that I could not possibly be the author of the note, "have some books by H.L. Mencken?" I forged the white man's name. I entered the library, as I had always done when on errands for whites, but I felt that I would somehow slip up and betray myself. I doffed my hat, stood a respectful distance from the desk, looked as unbookish as possible, and waited for the white patrons to be taken care of. When the desk was clear of people, I still waited. The white librarian looked at me. "What do you want, boy?" As though I did not possess the power of speech, I stepped forward and simply handed her the forged note, not parting my lips. "What books by Mencken does he want?" she asked. "I don't know, ma'am," I said, avoiding her eyes. "Who gave you this card?" "Mr. Falk," I said. "Where is he?" "He's at work, at the M Optical Company," I said. "I've been in here for him before." "I remember," the woman said, "but he never wrote notes like this." Oh God, she's suspicious. Perhaps she would not let me have the books. If she had turned her back at that moment, I would have ducked out the door and never gone back. Then I thought of a bold idea. "You can call him up, ma'am," I said, my heart pounding. "You're not using these books, are you?" she asked pointedly. "Oh no, ma'am, I can't read." "I don't know what he wants by Mencken," she said under her breath. I knew now that I had won. She was thinking of other things, and the race question had gone out of her mind. She went to the shelves. Once or twice, she looked over her shoulder at me, as though she was still doubtful. Finally, she came forward with two books in her hand. "I'm sending him two books," she said, "but tell Mr. Falk to come in next time, or send me the names of the books he wants. I don't know what he wants to read." I said nothing. She stamped the card and handed me the books. Not daring to glance at them, I went out of the library, fearing that the woman would call me back for further questioning. A block away from the library, I opened one of the books and read a title, A Book of Prefaces. I was nearing my 19th birthday, and I did not know how to pronounce the word preface. I thumbed the pages and saw strange words and strange names. I shook my head, disappointed. I looked at the other book. It was called Prejudices. I knew what that word meant. I had heard it all my life. And right off, I was on guard against Mencken's books. Why would a man want to call a book prejudices? The word was so stained with all my memories of racial hate that I could not conceive of anybody using it for a title. Perhaps I had made a mistake about Mencken. A man who had prejudices must be wrong. When I showed the books to Mr. Falk, he looked at me and frowned. "That librarian might telephone you," I warned him. "That's all right," he said. "But when you're through reading those books, I want you to tell me what you get out of them." That night, in my rented room, while letting the hot water run over my can of pork and beans in the sink, I opened A Book of Prefaces and began to read. I was jarred and shocked by the style, the clear, clean, sweeping sentences. Why did he write like that? And how did one write like that? I pictured the man as a raging demon, slashing with his pen, consumed with hate, denouncing everything American, extolling everything European or German, laughing at the weaknesses of people, mocking God, authority. What was this? I stood up, trying to realize what reality lay behind the meaning of the words. Yes, this man was fighting with words. He was using words as a weapon, using them as one would use a club. Could words be weapons? Well, yes, for here they were. Then maybe, perhaps, I could use them as a weapon. No, it frightened me. I read on, and what amazed me was not what he said, but how on earth anybody had the courage to say it. Occasionally, I glanced up to reassure myself that I was alone in the room. Who were these men about whom Mencken was talking so passionately? Who was Anatole France, Joseph Conrad, Sinclair Lewis, Sherwood Anderson, Dostoevsky, George Moore, Gustave Flaubert, Maupassant, Tolstoy, Frank Harris, Mark Twain, Thomas Hardy, Arnold Bennett, Stephen Crane, Zola, Norris, Gorky, Bergson, Ibsen, Balzac, Bernard Shaw, Dumas, Poe, Thomas Mann, O. Henry, Dreiser, H.G. Wells, Gogol, T.S. Eliot, Guide, Baudelaire, Edgar Lee Masters, Stendhal, Turgenev, Huneker, Nietzsche, and scores of others. Were these men real? Did they exist? Or had they existed? And how did one pronounce their names? I ran across many words whose meanings I did not know, and I either looked them up in a dictionary, or, before I had a chance to do that, encountered the word in a context that made its meaning clear. But what strange world was this? I concluded the book with the conviction that I had somehow overlooked something terribly important in life. I had once tried to write, had once reveled in feeling, had let my crude imagination roam, but the impulse to dream had been slowly beaten out of me by experience. Now it surged up again, and I hungered for books, new ways of looking and seeing. It was not a matter of believing or disbelieving what I read, but of feeling something new, of being affected by something that made the look of the world different. As dawn broke, I ate my pork and beans, feeling dopey, sleepy. I went to work. But the mood of the book would not die. It lingered, coloring everything I saw, heard, did. I now felt that I knew what the white men were feeling, merely because I had read a book that had spoken of how they lived and thought. I identified myself with that book. I felt vaguely guilty. Would I, filled with bookish notions, act in a manner that would make the whites dislike me? I forged more notes, and my trips to the library became frequent. Reading grew into a passion. My first serious novel was Sinclair Lewis's Main Street. It made me see my boss, Mr. Gerald, and identify him as an American type. I would smile when I saw him lugging his golf bags into the office. I had always felt a vast distance separating me from the boss, and now I felt closer to him, though still distant. I felt now that I knew him, that I could feel the very limits of his narrow life. and this had happened because I had read a novel about a mythical man called George F. Babbitt. The plots and stories in the novels did not interest me so much as the point of view revealed. I gave myself over to each novel without reserve, without trying to criticize it. It was enough for me to see and feel something different. And for me, everything was something different. Reading was like a drug, a dope. The novels created moods in which I lived for days, but I could not conquer my sense of guilt, my feeling that the white men around me knew that I was changing, that I had begun to regard them differently. Whenever I brought a book to the job, I wrapped it in newspaper, a habit that was to persist for years in other cities and under other circumstances. But some of the white men pried into my packages when I was absent, and they questioned me. "Boy, what are you reading those books for?" "Oh, I don't know, sir." "That's deep stuff you're reading, boy." "I'm just killing time, sir." "You'll addle your brains if you don't watch out." I read Dreiser's Jenny Gerhardt and Sister Carrie, and they revived me in the vivid sense of my mother's suffering. I was overwhelmed. I grew silent, wondering about the life around me. It would have been impossible for me to have told anyone what I derived from these novels, for it was nothing less than a sense of life itself. All my life had shaped me for the realism, the naturalism of the modern novel, and I could not read enough of them. Steeped in new moods and ideas, I bought a ream of paper and tried to write, but nothing would come. Or what did come was flat beyond telling. I discovered that more than desire and feeling were necessary to write, and I dropped the idea. Yet I still wondered how it was possible to know people sufficiently to write about them. Could I ever learn about life and people? To me, with my vast ignorance, my Jim Crow station in life, it seemed a task impossible of achievement. I knew what being a Negro meant. I could endure the hunger. I had learned to live with hate. But to feel that there were feelings denied me, that the very breath of life itself was beyond my reach, that more than anything else hurt, wounded me. I had a new hunger. In buoying me up, reading also cast me down, made me see what was possible, what I had missed. My tension returned. New, terrible, bitter, surging, almost too great to be contained. I no longer felt that the world about me was hostile, killing. I knew it. A million times I asked myself what I could do to save myself, and there were no answers. I seemed forever condemned, ringed by walls. I did not discuss my reading with Mr. Falk, who had lent me his library card. It would have meant talking about myself, and that would have been too painful. I smiled each day, fighting desperately to maintain my old behavior, to keep my disposition seemingly sunny, but some of the white men discerned that I had begun to brood. "Wake up there, boy," Mr. Olin said one day. "Sir," I answered for the lack of a better word. "You act like you've stolen something," he said. I laughed in the way I knew he expected me to laugh, but I resolved to be more conscious of myself, to watch my every act, to guard and hide the new knowledge that was dawning within me. If I went north, would it be possible for me to build a new life then? But how could a man build a life upon vague, unformed yearnings? I wanted to write, and I did not even know the English language. I bought English grammars and found them dull. I felt that I was getting a better sense of the language from novels than from grammars. I read hard, discarding a writer as soon as I felt that I had grasped his point of view. At night, the printed page stood before my eyes in sleep. Mrs. Moss, my landlady, asked me one Sunday morning, "Son, what is this you keep on reading?" "Oh, nothing, just novels." "What you get out of them?" "I'm just killing time," I said. "I hope you know your own mind," she said in a tone which implied that she doubted if I had a mind. I knew of no Negroes who read the books I liked, and I wondered if any Negroes ever thought of them. I knew that there were Negro doctors, lawyers, newspapermen, but I never saw any of them. When I read a Negro newspaper, I never caught the faintest echo of my preoccupation in its pages. I felt trapped, and occasionally, for a few days, I would stop reading, but a vague hunger would come over me for books, books that opened up new avenues of feeling and seeing, and again, I would forge another note to the white librarian. Again, I would read and wonder, as only the naive and unlettered can read and wonder, feeling that I carried a secret criminal burden about with me each day. That winter, my mother and brother came and we set up housekeeping, buying furniture on the installment plan, being cheated, and yet knowing no way to avoid it. I began to eat warm food and, to my surprise, found that regular meals enabled me to read faster. I may have lived through many illnesses and survived them, never suspecting that I was ill. My brother obtained a job, and we began to save toward the trip north, plotting our time, setting tentative dates for departure. I told none of the white men on the job that I was planning to go north. I knew that the moment they felt I was thinking of the north, they would change toward me. It would have made them feel that I did not like the life I was living. And because my life was completely conditioned by what they said or did, it would have been tantamount to challenging them. I could calculate my chances for life in the South as a Negro fairly clearly now. I could fight the Southern whites by organizing with other Negroes, as my grandfather had done, but I knew that I could never win that way. There were many whites, and there were but few blacks. They were strong, and we were weak. Outright black rebellion could never win. If I fought openly, I would die, and I did not want to die. News of lynchings were frequent. I could submit and live the life of a genial slave, but that was impossible. All of my life had shaped me to live by my own feelings and thoughts. I could make up to Bess and marry her and inherit the house, but that too would be the life of a slave. If I did that, I would crush to death something within me, and I would hate myself as much as I knew the whites already hated those who had submitted. Neither could I ever willingly present myself to be kicked, as Shorty had done. I would rather have died than do that. I could drain off my restlessness by fighting with Shorty and Harrison. I had seen many Negroes solve the problem of being black by transferring their hatred of themselves to others with a black skin and fighting them. I would have to be cold to do that, and I was not cold, and I could never be. I could, of course, forget what I had read, thrust the whites out of my mind, forget them, and find release from anxiety and longing in sex and alcohol. But the memory of how my father had conducted himself made that course repugnant. If I did not want others to violate my life, how could I voluntarily violate it myself? I had no hope whatever of being a professional man. Not only had I been so conditioned that I did not desire it, but the fulfillment of such an ambition was beyond my capabilities. Well-to-do Negroes lived in a world that was almost as alien to me as the world inhabited by whites. What then was there? I held my life in my mind, in my consciousness each day, feeling at times that I would stumble and drop it, spill it forever. My reading had created a vast sense of distance between me and the world in which I lived and tried to make a living, and that sense of distance was increasing each day. My days and nights were one long, quiet, continuously contained dream of terror, tension, and anxiety. I wondered how long I could bear it.